I'm Ben Sawyer.
I'm Bob Crawford.
And this is The Road to Now. Bob Crawford, this holiday's coming up, man.
It is. The road is coming to an end. It's so weird how we how our lives are set up with the holiday season and then New Year. And it's like, this is like a cutoff point, right?
Yeah.
But it really isn't.
I know. That's why when you said the end is near, I was like, what?
I'm scheduling things in my life for January. We all are. We're all like, okay, well then after the, and it seems like this is going to be this great divide between, you know, Christmas and New Year's and then what comes next, but really just a couple weeks away, you know, it's not a big deal. Something that is coming up that I'd like to mention is this hoodie I'm wearing that you can't see if you're listening, but maybe you can see on YouTube.
It's got a tree on
it. It's got a tree on it, but this is the fourth annual Press On fundraiser put on by the Avett Brothers fans. And I guess you can go on Facebook and search. I'm not on Facebook. This is the only thing worth seeing on Facebook because I am unapologetically anti-Facebook, but it's the fourth annual unofficial Avett Fan New Year's Eve fundraiser for Press On Fund. And you search that out on Facebook and then you can order, this is the hoodie. And they didn't just like, hey, let's send some merch to the Crawfords. They didn't do this. No, we saw this posted online and we purchased a bunch for our friends and family and for ourselves. And this is like Mr. Rogers' sweater vest for me. I get up in the morning or come home and I put this thing on and I'm just relaxed and comfortable for the rest of the day. So everybody should go online. Avett Fan unofficial New Year's Eve fundraiser for Press On Fund. Check it out. The merchandise this year, it's always great, but it's really beautifully designed and very comfortable apparel.
Yes, Bob. I just want to clarify here. Bob said this is like Mr. Rogers' house vest or whatever, house sweater for me.
Yeah,
I want to say it doesn't look like that at all because people can't see it.
It doesn't look like that.
I gave up a little bit. Love children, gave up.
But it's the 2021 version.
Yeah, they're great. And as you guys who were listening last year, it went online, right? Because we couldn't do anything live. And that was, we used the Road to Now's Zoom account since we had the big Zoom account. And I actually hosted that one with some great recorded performances. And, let me say this. I had a great time last year, but I'm happy that we're at a point where it doesn't have to everything be online. So yeah, it's great. And Tanya Marsh, everybody who does that, shout out to them.
That's right. Thank you so much. And hopefully, Ben, you can clip this and put this on Instagram or this little
promo. Hey, we got all the video of this stuff, man. You know me, I look like a rat built a nest in my head and gave up. Looked like the rat was like, this isn't good enough for me. So I don't know. We'll put you up there, Bob.
Well, thank you.
One thing I want to say before we go into this, though, is some of you guys are looking for Christmas gifts for people you love. La Cosecha Coffee. Nobody's ever been disappointed with that one. It's a great gift.
That's right.
La Cosecha does like subscription plans. They've been a great sponsor for a long time. And just me sitting around thinking, what do I get for people? It's like good coffee that comes every month. I mean, I love it. The times that people have done things like that for me. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, you can do that subscription and it keeps going. And you can go to lacosechacoffee.com. That's LACOSECHA.com. Love those guys. And a lot of you guys have supported them. And thank you for doing that because we genuinely love that company and Jamie who runs it. So if you guys check that out. And just to be clear here, this is not a paid sponsorship. I mean, they support us and we have a certain deal. Like I'm saying this in the introduction because literally I would want someone to recommend something like that for me if I wasn't thinking about it. And it's great coffee. So,
you know what another great Christmas present would be? The new Andrew Polk book.
Oh my God. I think you're right.
And for Faith and Freedom.
I know. People are like, what's that laughing in the background?
You know what stinks? I take the jackets off when I read them and stuff, which the jacket for Andrew's book is awesome. There it is
That's what I told him. It came in the mail, I told him, I was like, this is the greatest cover ever. It is epic. This cover
badass.
Is active.
It's badass.
Yes.
It's badass.
Faith and Freedom, Propaganda, Presidential Politics, and the Making of an American Religion. This is coming out the week that this episode airs in December of 2021. You guys are like, hey, is Andy in the room with somebody? He is. He's my colleague here at MTSU. We're in my office recording. And
here I
he's,
am.
He, I got to say, me and my wife, Kelly Kolar, have been big fans of Andy Polk since he first came to MTSU. And I think we have elevated that even more after this book. So let's get into it. Bob, you want to, let's kick off this conversation.
Well, yeah, I was saying to Andy right before we started that it's really great when a historian writes a book and then the same week they're about to put out their book, something is happening in the country or in their state or in their community that kind of underscores the topic of the book and allows them to contribute to the current conversation. Andy, your op-ed from, I guess it came out Sunday in the Tennessean, is entitled, When You Hear in God We Trust, Pay Attention to What Comes Next. What were you talking about in the op-ed?
Yeah, this is a new movement within Tennessee. Tennessee's not unique with it, but there are two bills that have come out, one from a year and a half ago, in which the legislature required for all public schools in Tennessee, they have to post somewhere in the building where students regularly see it, the words, In God We Trust. And this is somehow going to transform public education, bring religion back in the schools. And then when Tennessee has redone their license plates, In God We Trust is now going to be over and around the symbol of the outline of the state of Tennessee. To get around legal issues that they knew were going to come, it's not mandatory. So you can opt into it, or technically you can opt out of it, but it's still on there. You don't pay any more money. It's not a specialized license plate. That is the Tennessee license plate. So it struck me when reading about this, when you hear several legislators were talking about it, they just kept mentioning, well, this is the motto of the nation. It was there at the beginning of the nation. It's on our paper money. It's exactly the way that America understands itself. And so we just have to put that out there to make sure we educate the people. And of course, the problem is that's just fundamentally false. It's just historically inaccurate. And it's the way that politicians continue to use these type of terms. So,
but surely politicians just started using these type of terms.
Yeah. It's really new. Yeah.
Otherwise, somebody would write a book about maybe the history of politicians using these terms.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. This is the deal. It's as you alluded to beforehand, even the idea of Christian nationalism that people talk about, right? This idea that America was founded as a Christian nation and that somehow patriotism and faith go hand in hand. That's been there for a very long time in the nation's history. What I discovered is that what we talk about now when we talk about like civil religion or Christian nationalism, this idea that America was founded as a Christian nation. It has this Judeo-Christian foundation at its heart. And that is always paired with the idea that we are a free market. We are ultra-capitalists, that socialism is the devil, and that we must have a large and expansive military to protect these freedoms. That's always the construction, right? Those go hand in hand. People talk about these together. I discovered that was... that has not been talked about throughout American history, that came about in the 40s and 50s, and it was not by accident that presidents, FDR, Truman, and Eisenhower, they constructed that on purpose with help of professional propagandists, explicit propagandists that they hired to tell the American people that's what America was.
And This is always the thing that gets me. I mean, we had John Fia on a while back. Mm-hmm. We've had talked to him a couple of times. And, you know, this it kind of taps into that for those of you guys who know this. Like, Fia wrote that book, Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? And if you'll recall, it's one of my favorite things. We said, you know, so let's talk about the title of the book. You know, was America founded as a Christian nation? His first response was, that's not even a question. My publisher made me make it that title. Because there is, and what you're up against here is, again, you quote one of the members of our legislature who co-sponsored this bill to put In God We Trust on there, making these kind of broad claims, right? It taps into this myth-making. And so what I love about it is that, you know, we for a long time can go back and we can look and we can say, was the Constitution founded as a Christian document? Well, it doesn't mention Jesus one time or God. And to me, that's kind of a, it's a weird thing where people feel like they need to make it do that, right? Because the way I explain it to my students is, if you're a Christian, is everything you do inherently Christian? Like if I'm a Christian and I change the oil in my truck, was it a Christian oil change? That's obviously an absurd question, but that can be possible. And what you're doing is you were saying, okay, we can test this against the founding documents, but now you're saying, let's actually look at how this evolved, this notion that people now make these claims. And you say it goes back to Roosevelt in the lead up to World War II.
Yeah, yeah, but absolutely.
Andy, just real quick with the In God We Trust, you point out in the introduction to your book, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, that begins to come in at the Civil War, because in the South, when they wrote the Confederate States Constitution, they said, well, God isn't in the United States Constitution, but we're going to put it in our Constitution. So the Confederacy puts God in their Constitution. So the North has to add God somewhere. And they come up with this motto, In God We Trust. They put it on the money.
Yeah, because in America, what's more important than the Constitution? It's money. So
it all goes together.
So let's go back to Roosevelt, right? Because there's a gap after that. Uh-huh. And then Roosevelt, and you know, a lot of people I don't think get this. Roosevelt saw World War II coming. He wanted the United States to intervene. Mm-hmm. Popular opinion was against it. So he's, in his mind, this Episcopalian FDR says, we need to appeal to these folks. And he thinks that God is the best way to do it. And could you just pick up there? Because he fails.
Yeah, there's even going back to the In God We Trust at Civil War, all of this comes to politicians have known for a while, right? That religion matters. It can matter to them personally, but it matters to their constituents. It matters to the nation. That even when we think about, you know, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and this is one of the cornerstones of American civil religion. But we usually talk about that in such a way that it's some natural development, right? That people just have the outpouring of their heart, that they have these religious sentiments, and that they love God and they love the nation. And so these things come together. There are times in which that's true. I don't think it's nearly as true as we believe, but it definitely wasn't true during this period. So Roosevelt needs to unify the nation, right? That's what he wants to do. So he talks, they have discussions over this. How do you unify the nation? We're so different. There's too many different elements together. You can't talk about race. It's too divisive. You can't talk about class. You can't even talk about ethnicity. So how do you talk about difference that equals unity? Well, what he decided, as you said, a good Episcopalian, there's this long movement at this point of joining together and this ecumenical spirit. He said, well, in the end, all Americans are either Catholics, Protestants, or Jews. And really, aren't all those the same thing? Right. Even this term Judeo-Christian, that was new. That's a mid-1930s thing when that came out. Right. So this is all in the zeitgeist at the time. And he said, well, so that's where we go, where everyone's religious and it's OK. And so he bumbled around this. He tried to go to religious leaders. He published, I start the book with these in chapter one, with these Christmas letters that he wrote to the representatives of Catholicism, Protestantism, and Judaism in America, which Catholicism, you have a pope. Protestantism in Judaism, like what he just picked people. And even in his letter to the Jewish representative, he talks about Christmas and Jesus coming in the world. Like it's the most absurd, even ecumenical idea. And this confounded everyone, especially when he wrote to that he was going to send a personal representative to the pope. And Protestants freaked out about this. He didn't understand why they freaked out about it. The group that he wrote to had to tell him, we don't represent all Protestants in America. You know that, right? Like the conservatives hate us and there's tens of millions of them. And he's like, what? So he tried through this process and then continuously did this. When they did the draft, they tried to redefine the God whom you could appeal to be a conscientious objector. That he came out and against... He basically, when when Operation Barbarossa, when the Nazis turned against the Soviet Union and invaded, now the Soviet Union is on our side, but they're communists and we hate communists. So he had a press conference and we tried to convince the American people the Soviet Union is actually pro-religious freedom because they say that you can't preach religion. So that's actually the foundation. And no one bought this. They mocked him on this. And when that didn't work, he came up with an idea of saying, this will sound familiar because this got reused over and over. If we don't stop the Nazis, the Nazis hate our religious freedom. They hate our religion. And they will, if we allow the Nazis to continue, they will replace the cross that we know of Jesus Christ with a cross of blood and iron. And so stopping the Nazis, which we weren't in yet, this is pre-Pearl Harbor, stopping the Nazis is saving religion. And that's what America is for. And then this development continues from there.
Right. Throughout the book, what struck me is that you are showing how the government worked around the actual religious organizations to create this American religion and replacing a lot of these groups with the Ad Council. This, you know, the Ad Council, they are a big part of this. But talk about how Truman and Eisenhower in particular were frustrated by religious groups and found themselves working outside of religious groups. And who were these early propagandists like the Ad Council? You know, introduce us to these guys.
Yeah, this was the development as it came on. So FDR is the one who originally tried this. He became convinced this is the way to unite the people, but he kept trying to use religious representatives, and they would not go along with it. During World War II, once we entered, things changed a little bit. Most of this was on the ground stuff for religious revivals among the troops. There's a process called general services that they had during the military. It was actually designed originally for Catholic priests to be able to give Protestant services. That's what it's for, just a general service that can happen. What happened is the chaplains just used general services to make a general religious service. Right. I mean, they would just go ahead and give the Eucharist to Catholics because we're all the same. It's a general service. They would invite Jews to come and celebrate, and they would do all this together. And this freaked out military officials, other government officials, at the same time that they're trying to promote this idea that in the end, Protestants, Catholics, and Jews are all Americans, and they all believe the same stuff. One God that loves America, and we're on God's side. I mean, that's it. That's as sophisticated as God. Well, as this process went on, Roosevelt found two allies that worked better. One was the Office of War Information, which was originally designed Roosevelt was explicit, we're not going to do propaganda like the First World War. We're just going to give the media the facts, and then they're going to disseminate this to the American people. That lasted like 3 months. And then Roosevelt said, they're not doing it well. Like we have to actually go and tell them the story, the right, so that they can do it. Yeah. And that was combined with this group. During the war, they called themselves the War Advertising Council, a bunch of ad executives that were terrified the government was going to shut them down. And so they offered their services to the government free of charge. So their corporate sponsors would pay them, the government would tell them the message, and then they would convince the American people.
Yeah, and the thing that I think so brilliant about this early level, kind of when this is being built and then the groundwork's being laid, you say, none of these people are having deep theological conversations. No. None of these folks are looking at actual history. Like, it's advertising people, right? And it's about messaging and finding what resonates with people. And so in doing so, you know, you say FDR goes to these people who are representatives of their individual faiths. He finds them very unruly and difficult to work with and uncooperative, and actually coming back with, you know, things like facts that make that frustrate FDR. So he goes, you know who will do this? Someone who has to obey me, basically.
That's right. Yeah.
How much of this, because, you know, one of the things that we think about the New Deal is we think, you know, the Democrats control Congress, but there's throughout the split, the fact that Southern Democrats are beginning to form as their own faction, really kind of in this first days as a response to the New Deal, right? So how much of this is aimed at his own attempt to find something that can skirt the issue of race within his own party?
that became explicit with Truman and especially Eisenhower. FDR was just groping in the dark. He wanted to find unity. He thought religion was an avenue to do it. So the basic elements of this type of propaganda, this what we call Christian nationalism now, he started, but he just didn't do very well with it. He never really had the groups behind him. And this goes to your previous question, Bob, that once Truman decided to do the same thing. So the War Advertising Council, the Office of War Information, got in trouble because they mentioned race too much. They were censured by Congress. Their budget for, quote, domestic propaganda, like that's the budget line, domestic propaganda. It was cut. It was given to these advertisers because they were better at it. And they had a meeting with Roosevelt, the vice president, the secretary of war, the what would become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs for what was called, quote, secret indoctrination talks. Like, that's what they called it. Like, it's like you're going to tell the people. So when Truman took over, Truman wanted to do this, but Truman saw these things together. He first tried to go back through, especially the Federal Council of Churches. This was like the big ecumenical liberal Protestant group. He thought he could work with them. He used the same messaging. The Advertising Council dropped war and they went together. But it came to a head because these liberal Protestants kept sending him reports of how he should run the country, which he was incensed over. Like, the UN should be supreme and we should demilitarize everything. And my favorite, they sent him a program called A Program for Peace. This was policy recommendations to the President of the United States. And he wrote, hand wrote on the top of the copy, "This document is full of sophistry as a communist manifesto. Let's analyze it for what it is," and gave it to his aide and just dropped them. Just said, "I'm done with them."
That's what I love. Like, I love the way that Truman, I guess he was, maybe he was in the Senate when all this went down with FDR forming this. But like, he goes, you know, I can do this. I can do what wasn't possible before. But then he approaches it. You know, one side of the argument about Truman and the problems of Truman's presidency is that he saw everything in black and white.
Yes.
Either you were with us or against us. And that led from like a working cooperation with the Soviets to like outright Cold War.
Yeah.
So you see that type of his characteristics coming out in dealing with this as well,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. He knows what's right. He knows what's true. It's straight line. That's the way it works. This is what's best for the country. And if you can't go along with it and it doesn't really fit.
So then he goes back to the same people that FDR worked with.
Yep. The Advertising Council, they offered their services. They figured out this works so much. This is the same people, Loose Lips, Sink Ships, and Smokey the Bear and all this stuff, right? So they come together and they decide, literally they ask the government, what do you want us to tell the American people? And the government tells them. And one of those was religious freedom, religious unity. And so they come on and they become the keys to this. So there were a bunch of big programs for this in the 40s. One of the most explicit, the first one's called the Freedom Train. So the Ad Council, they partnered with this group called the American Heritage Foundation. They may sound familiar too. Mostly conservative business magnates, Hollywood moguls, all these people. They came together. And the purpose of it, the ad exec who was in charge, Thomas Darcy Brophy, said the purpose was to resell Americanism to Americans, like to tell Americans what it was. And so this train, a literal train, had like Washington's copy of the Constitution, Jefferson's copy of the Declaration, and it would go across the country and they would have what they called patriotic revival meetings. And they would combine all this stuff together. And they had a big discussion. And they said, well, if we're defining America, how do we define it? And the attorney general, who was also involved in this process, this is insane. The attorney general was meeting to tell Americans what America was. He said, well, we should define it as equality. And the ad council said, you can't do that. What, you want to sell equality in the South? You're like, you can't. There are too many connotations. You can't do it. And they bandied about possibilities. And what they came up with was freedom. Because everyone loves freedom. No one hears, do you like freedom? It's okay sometimes. Freedom's great. If you think about it, freedom is an incredibly vague term. It means almost nothing. To be free from oppression, right? It's a completely subjective term. But what they figured out rhetorically, it works well. Because you define America by freedom, which means freedom of religion, which means free enterprise, And then you have to have a large standing army to protect those.
Right.
And this became everything coming together. And so they sold this and then just continued on. They had a United America campaign, one called Religion and American Life. This is where the term families that pray together, stay together, which I've heard throughout evangelical churches in America, that was an ad council program, Religion and American Life. And it was so prominent. They had 500 million listener impressions in November of 1949 alone. That in listener impression is the way they gauged it at the time. That was one person or household hearing their message once. And they had 500 million in 1 month. This was everywhere on billboards, on loaves of bread. You pick up your bread at the grocery store and it has Religion and American Life. Worship at your synagogue or church of your choice.
Talk about, and that's A.G. Clark, you were talking about, the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. Talk for a minute about this this theme that began to purvey that discussing race was unpatriotic.
Yes.
Yeah, this developed alongside, absolutely. Yeah, race matters in this because it said beforehand, race is too divisive. And what they figured out through this process through the Second World War and especially early on, they didn't want to talk about race. And it's not just that they didn't talk about it. They decided that in this formulation, to talk about race, specifically bringing up the many racial injustices in the country, to talk about race is to be unpatriotic. To bring up any of America's weaknesses helps their enemies, right? Helps America's enemies. And so if you bring up racial disparities, racial injustice, you are being un-American. And when this formulation comes together, you are in essence being heretical. That's where this becomes so dangerous. That I know y'all have talked about so much on the show, right? The way we talk about the past matters. One of my students call them polkisms. I have sayings I pull out all the time. Is people tell stories of the past to give meaning to the present, right? Even if you don't like history, people use history all the time. And so this one is, I think, so problematic because I have no problem with people being patriotic. Of course not. I have no problem with people being religious, right? I have my own personal faith. The problem is when they become so combined that people can't see out of those. They become the same thing. So to go against your understanding of patriotism is to be heretical, to go against God, to not be a Christian. And that formulation became so tight that even bringing up racial injustice was both unpatriotic and unchristian. And so they went out of their way to make sure that that did not happen. You don't discuss race in America if you love America.
So the first thing I thought of when I read this was Virginia gubernatorial election, critical race theory.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is the exact same thing that won, what's his name, in Virginia, the governorship.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blanking on his name, but anyway, but this, just a couple weeks ago, I mean, this isn't from the 40s and 50s. This is in the 2020s.
That's right. Yeah, this is the legacy, right? So I can't say that there's a straight line from this, but when you hear people talk about these same issues today, there's so many times that I'll be like, well, they're quoting. Like, I can point back when that was created. There was a room in which they figured out this works. They sold it, and then it's being repeated today. And that is one of the legacies of this, idea that if you bring up race, you are criticizing America, right? That America is not the greatest nation in the world, and you can't bring it up. Critical race theory, the idea that systemic racism would be there, the idea that America was founded on a race, that is not just unpatriotic. It's not just problematic. It is almost unholy, right? It's heretical from this perspective, especially of white evangelicals. I got this so much that Bob was talking about when I published this op-ed, which is online. It's going to be in the print edition Sunday, so I'm looking forward to those emails. I have officially reached the hate mail stage of my career. In most of those, ironically follow this same thing. Well, you're criticizing this. You're simply bringing up the idea that these ideas, religious concepts are used for political purposes. You must hate Christianity. I bet you love Karl Marx. How can you be a communist that wants to destroy America? Like, the jumping between these, like, you, this hate mail proves my point. Like, you are combining these together in ways that don't really make sense if you think about them, but they've been combined for so long that people don't see out of it. They're not dumb,
yeah,
right? They just, this is the story. This is the way they understand the world. But that was created, and it was created for purposes, and that matters. It should matter, I think.
Yeah, this conflation is what fascinates me, because you, in the book, we're talking about this and building this model of, like, you know, the canon, the icons of America. The thing, like, that I had never thought about with this is how the military fits into it. Yeah. And it makes sense, because, you know, the military is, like, revered in this country. And I'll always say, in this weird way where everyone's like, support the troops, but also our computers are old, so nobody's getting the GI Bill.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? This stuff kills me, because it's like, you say, everyone's, it's the one thing we agree upon.
Yep.
And then no one does anything about it.
Yeah.
But so you've got this, and that's what's fascinating to me, is that because it's so ingrained, like 16 million Americans serve in World War II, and they come out of it, and then, you know, the question, there's this weird period where the U.S. goes to essentially decommission its army, right, to send people home, and then it gets surged back up, right, with Cold War, with Korea, and the lead up to Korea, and there's this moment in there where Truman issues an executive order desegregating the military.
Yep.
And this, to me, is 48. And a lot of people are furious about this. It, by the way, just so you guys know, in fact, the American Army was not segregated early on in the American Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
It was resegregated in the War of 1812. This cotton plantation interests get a little more leverage at that point. And then 48, Truman orders it to be desegregated. So at the same time, you have him issuing these orders, right? We don't talk about race, but the military becomes this, like, this legendary, mythical, you know, part of this story. How does Truman negotiate that? Or does it, or is it that by making the military kind of untouchable, he's then allowed to do it because it stands outside, you know, standard criticisms?
Yeah, I think the key word there is negotiate. There was the military was a part of this also, right? As you said, one of the great American traditions is we don't have a large standing army. Like, that's one of the only things that the generations of who we call founding fathers agreed on. The greatest threat to a democracy is a large standing army, because if you have it, you're going to use it. And if someone has control, they're probably going to take control. And so America didn't have a standing army. We raised an army. We saved the world, two-time World War champs, right? And then we come back and we immediately dismantle the military. That's what we do. But after the Second World War, because of technological advancements, Truman and military commanders said, we can't do that anymore. We can't afford to do it. And so we have to have the military. It has to continue on. Well, how do you do that? So many people have served. They want to come back home. They want to be a new normal. Truman proposed something called universal military training, which is where everyone, all young men would serve. They wouldn't serve technically in the military, but would they receive technical or military training, and they would all come together. The military was on board with this. They had to do. But the problem with all of it is America's mothers rose up and said, that's not going to happen. Because up until that day, for about a century, the idea was when you go to the military, that's when you become morally corrupted. Right. That's in World War One and World War Two. You come back with syphilis. That's what happens when you go to the military. It's prostitution. It's cussing. It's smoking. It's drinking. It's all this. And so this was a big problem. How do you do this when you have all these education and health constituents against it? So Truman, there were two tracks of this, because the military didn't want to use the civilian propagandists explicitly. So they created their own. The biggest was called the Fort Knox Experimental Unit. And they created a new type of essentially academy, a training facility for 18-year-olds mostly. They just come into the army. And it had a chapel at its center. They had sex education classes that said God designed us to be in marriage with one man and one woman, and you not have sex until you're married. They had to go to religious services. The idea, but all of this, the idea was to promote this to America, especially America's mothers. And that their public relations department at Fort Knox was so massive and so omnipresent that the U.S. Congress convened a special subcommittee that eventually censured them for, quote, domestic propaganda efforts.
Yeah.
And at that point, the military just took all that money. They said, oh, I'm sorry, we actually disbanded that a few months ago. And they put it into what they called the character education program because they already had a proof of concept. And so they used that throughout the entire military. So these things are all going on at the same time. So the military is sacrosanct. It's good. They're the best of America. But you're exactly right. Race, when Truman tried to say you should, you must integrate, essentially the military, especially the Army and what had just been formed, the Air Force, said, we're not doing that. We're not a social experiment. That's what we do. At the same time, they created their own public relations department to tell them we're a social experiment creating religious unity throughout the nation. By the time Korea came, it didn't matter. The military didn't really fully integrate until Korea, right? Because they had to, because just the battlefield conditions said we need people, and it worked. And then they figured out, oh, well, it turns out everything we were worried about wasn't there. So you can segment these things at different times in ways that are rationally kind of insane. But it works.
What
it
a different
works.
World. Because, you know, it's like you go after World War II, you've got this, you know, teaching people about, you know, monogamy. And yeah. What a different world it was. And during the Civil War in Nashville, Rosencrantz just legalized prostitution so that he could try to deal with the syphilis problem.
Yeah. Works well. Yeah.
You point out this ecumenical idea of the government trying to bring all religions together was flawed in the United States because there was the conservative Christianity and there's liberal Christianity, and the two were very opposed to one another in their own doctrines and the way they saw the world around them. What was the impact on religious groups as a result of this government expansion and this government religion? What was the church in the 50s and 60s, what was the impact on the church itself?
I would argue the impact was the way that they thought about and talked about conservative and liberal. So especially among American Protestants, the largest group, when there were quote-unquote liberal or progressive Protestants, there were quote-unquote conservative or fundamentalist Protestants. And the fundamentalist comes from a series of pamphlets called The Fundamentals from 1910 to 1915. That's where the term comes from, which was defending an inerrant view of Scripture. And that's what they argued about. What was the nature of Scripture? Was it perfect, right? Was it without error? Was it literal or not, right? Was it a real Virgin Mary, or was that a misunderstanding of an Isaiah passage? That's what they were arguing about the whole time. Until this movement of religious propaganda in the 40s and the 50s. And what you see is liberal Protestants were fully on board with this. They weren't in charge of it. They were usually reacting to it. But they saw this religious boom. This is the holy 50s, right? Where everyone's going to church and synagogue, and over 90% of Americans profess to be Jews or Christians. And this was a big boom. But by the time you get to the mid-50s, even liberals who had participated in the creation of this, they started to speak out against it. But what they spoke out against was no longer Jesus' virgin birth or a literal six-day creation. It was the efficacy of the United Nations. It was America's military policies abroad. It was issues of economics and how much control that corporations had and whether America should step into it, right? So even though they define themselves as these religious camps of Protestants who have different understandings of God and different doctrinal traditions, when they talked about each other and defined each other, They were defining each other by embracing. Conservative Protestants, especially through Billy Graham, embraced this through Eisenhower's term, or they were denying that. But even the way that supposedly liberal and conservative Protestants understood themselves were on the political terms of these propagandists, the ones who created this construction, this myth, this understanding of America. And so it wasn't just religious. It was mostly political.
You know what's interesting about this is that, well, there's a lot that's interesting about this, but but the fact that this was all a government plan to foster unity in the country, yeah, right? To unify the country. But you point out that the unifying of the 30s, 40s, and 50s led to the fracturing of the 60s, 70s, and we're feeling it today. So talk about the fracturing that occurs in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, the issue that came up, and this became evident in the 50s, the early to mid 50s, especially when Black Americans rose up and said, hey, America's about freedom, right? What does that mean for us? A glaring hypocrisy of this entire thing. The reason is because the goal wasn't really unity, American unity. The goal was unity behind, right? It's unity behind America getting into the war. It's unity behind Truman's policies of understanding the Cold War on these stark, really religious terms and expansion of the military. The unity was for a purpose. So it didn't have to be real unity. It was always a facade, right? It's just garnering what one of Eisenhower's aides called religiously motivated action in the political sphere. And so once you get to that religiously motivated action and the politics don't align, right? Well, then the political disputes become almost religious disputes. And how can you have some type of unity when what we're talking about is not just a matter of policy, right, of stances, but they become somewhat understandably moral issues, right? When you're talking about race, when you're talking about gender disparities, when, right, second wave feminism rising up and saying this doesn't, when you have the anti-war movement, which is not just about a policy abroad, but also about who's drafted and who doesn't have to be drafted and what happens with the poor in America who are serving, right? All of these things come together and they started to align, as I said about especially Protestants, on whether or not they agreed or opposed this understanding of America. And it was a definition of America. And so even the language becomes ratcheted up, right? If you love America and they don't like, you hate America,
yeah,
right? Because you aren't for these things. Well, then liberals say, no, I don't hate America. I love America. The thing you're doing, you're ruining America. You are, right? And it continuously elevates over and over and over. And then when you get to the late 70s, early 80s of the moral majority, the religious right, right? When conservative Protestants really accept this wholesale, it becomes fully their understanding. Well, then this just continues to fracture over and over. You have Reagan Republicans that are part of this process. The religious right and white evangelicals are now stirred and moved, principally because of Green v. Connolly, not Roe v. Wade. That's another thing. Randy Balmer has written about this, right? It's more about the government having oversight really on racial issues than it was specifically, at least originally, about abortion. But all of this becomes so ingrained, you've now had a generation that's just what America is. And if you hate that, then you hate America or you don't understand America. And so the fracturing, certainly Donald Trump took a part of this, right? Over and over and over, he did this. He didn't create any of it. Yeah. And I have no doubt he didn't understand this. He wasn't just parroting the religious right in the 80s. It's a process that happened long beforehand. And this just continually divided Americans based on this idea. But when politicians create the idea of America, they're creating the stakes by which we have a conversation. And that's problematic.
So look at this. Rick Perlstein, you're Jeff Cowie. We've looked at, you know, these formations of things, the 70s, this kind of grand transformation of politics and the rise of the new right,
yeah,
which plays out in the 80s. And a lot of it seems to be kind of you know, we go, well, it's not just the 70s and 80s, it was in the 60s. And you're saying, actually, the frame upon which that was built goes way further back,
right,
to 39 when FDR decides he needs this. And so what you see is, yes, you see more being put onto that frame, and then certainly an acceleration of that. Mm-hmm. But the actual, the frame is there and being built in the 30s.
That's right. That's right. The whole right title of what y'all do, right? The Road to Now, it matters because it's not just a thing that happened many decades ago. We're still revisiting this. In some sense, we're still living this out. Once there became a definitive concept of America that combines all these things, again, that don't seem to make a lot of sense, right? This idea that I know many white evangelicals who are good, kind, loving, compassionate people, but they somehow ardently believe that the Bible is pro-capitalist. Yeah. I mean, that's insane on its face because of the beginnings of, like, that. It's impossible. Like, that doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, I remember one time Jesus gets angry. I can remember, like, one time.
That's right. It all fits. Yeah, he said some things, right? It's, you can argue about the theology, the doctrine, but that concept doesn't make sense. Historically, it's impossible.
Yeah.
But they're convinced of this, again, not because they're dumb, but because that's the story. That's what makes sense. They not only hear that when they were growing up in schools, they hear that in their churches from pulpits. They hear that in their Sunday schools. This is what America is. And once you get that formation that becomes so solid and these other things become stacked on top, well, now every fight is a fight to the end. Because it's a fight for the salvation of America and the salvation of souls and the way that we understand all of these things working together. And so we can't, it becomes increasingly hard to have conversations of nuance. And you and I love America, we have different ideas. Yeah. You and I support the military. Yeah. But so let's talk about military policies and funding and right.
Right.
But that's not what we're talking about. It's just love the military because they are. It's problematic for civic discourse. We can't have it.
It's interesting that the story is built around the facade of trying to build unity, but actually the story has such a built-in enemy, which That's is right. anyone who doubts, that you yourself throw the gauntlet down. And by doing so, you're saying, hey, I mean, and this is what's funny. I hear people saying this all the time, right? On my friends on the right and my friends on the left. Yeah. I wish we weren't so divided. And I go, yeah, me uh-huh. too. But those people... Uh-huh. As long as, and it's right. like, be careful. My thing is just, it's a red flag. Anytime the story you hear has a story in it that says, those people are the enemy and do not listen to them.
Yeah.
That's a red flag. Because the minute they're saying don't listen, that's the step towards dehumanization. And it's unfortunate. Bob, do you have another question? I've got one, like two last ones I want to ask.
No, I think you've covered, I was going to, my final question was going to be like, how is this moment Trumpism connected to what first occurred in the 40s and 50s, but I think you touched on that. I guess the final thing I would say is what I really gleaned from the book was, and being you know a person of faith, right? I'm a Christian, you know. I just reading, and I don't say this to say, I read the Bible every morning, but I was literally reading the Gospel of Luke this morning, and it is this idea of the upside down kingdom, and it is about poverty and about the Jubilee, which is returning the land to the people and the forgiveness of sins and letting debts be forgotten, right? Like, hey, let's just forget about these debts. What does it, you know, this, it's a time for a reset, where the people on the bottom are now going to be the people on the top. And that it's a radical political document is what it is. But what strikes me about your book is you tell the story of how that the theology of Christianity has been excised from the American document. The American religion has kind of expunged the actual faith and the actual Christianity out of it. It's just like the person who says, you must love Karl Marx. Well, we've taken Marx out of Marxism, right? I mean, you know, that's the whole thing, right? Marx, I think Marx should be thought about more in light of his historical theories rather than a blueprint to govern.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's all I have to say. And, I look forward to hearing Ben's questions here, but again, I'll commend you on a well conceived and, produced historical document.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I would say adding on to that, I had a conversation with someone, I think last week, about this. We just were talking about it casually, if you can talk about, intense propaganda and the disillusion of the American experiment casually. But the question was, how did this come about, right? Of Trump, of white evangelicalism now, of this militarization of the entire thing. How did this, is this a new development? Was it there? And my response is, when you've been told, when your conception of America, of patriotism has for generations been constructed on the idea of, again, the people who don't agree with this are the enemies, that they hate America, that they want to ruin this. Again, formed during World War II and the Cold War, right? That they want to destroy us, the ones who don't. Well, if that's your setup, when you get to that and combine it with some form of kind of evangelical apocalypticism, when you get to this modern day and you hear, right, Trump saying those explicit things, they hate America, they want to destroy us, when you have the very real demographic changes, when you have a movement to create some form of racial justice in America, to most people, losing power is the same thing as oppression, right? I can't do and say what I used to do, so that they interpret that as oppression. It's a loss of power. And when you have conceived of that in apocalyptic terms for so long, you're right, right? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the fact that really any theological content, I would argue, was just not a concern of this construction from the beginning. You therefore can't even have a theological conversation about this, because what you're talking about, as you say, is not Mary's Magnificat and the reversal of society in this Advent period, right? What we're talking about, oh, you hate America, you hate this, you're trying to destroy us, it's difficult to have those.
So we're not going to get into this here, but I throw it out there for water cooler talk for everybody out there is my idea, and it's not just my idea, but the fact is that Donald Trump doesn't fit this book, right? The idea of him, yeah, the man, that he doesn't fit in here. Oh wait, how do you hold it like this? How do you? he doesn't fit this Christianity. The man doesn't fit in these pages. Uh-huh. So QAnon is the faith built around the man, yes, to make him fit into the faith.
That's right.
Not time for that here, but discuss at the water cooler.
No, but it does talk. Make so much sense, because I myself, Bob, reading the book of Acts the other day, and again, it's like there's one guy in there who sells out his friend to get some land, and then he gets one line in the book of Acts. It's like, yeah, Judas was hanging out, got some land, and started to plow. It fell over, guts blew up everywhere. Anyway, moving on, they had to find somebody to replace him. Yeah. You're like, that dude gets one line in the book of Acts. So it's like, yeah, okay. So the guy who made compromises, right? But going back to the fact that it's like, you know, I've always said, it's like to people that go, you know, Christians are like this. I'm like, what are you talking about? Yeah. I mean, I've always found a huge rift between those who had the thing they wanted to conclude first and then work backwards, mm-hmm, right? And those who come to the faith with honest questions and reach conclusions. To me, that's too fun. That's not even the same group of people, right? Yeah. But it makes sense to me now, because it's like people who start with the conclusions that they want and work backwards, that's kind of the groundwork, mm-hmm, right? And the first people who did that didn't even work that hard backwards. They were like, this is what it is. And you go justify it. They're like, don't have to. Ad council will make some slogans. Yeah. And so it really, to me, helps explain where we've gotten with this and why I see people like Bob, you know, making beautiful and excellent arguments. My friend Josh Stump, who runs a cigar shop, is also a preacher. I see him making these incredibly articulate, compelling arguments that I feel like are based in humanity, right? Yeah. The essence of the teachings of Jesus. And people just go, nuh-uh. And you're like, what? You didn't feel that? And it's like, no, I was never reasoned into this.
Yeah.
So the last question I've got for you, aside from, like, you know, 3 hours of us being frustrated about this, I think we all share that. Are you related to James K. Polk?
I was thinking the same thing. Oh my gosh, Ben.
This is the big thing. Yeah.
Yes.
So my grandfather continuously got stuff in the mail and calls from, like, the Polk Foundation through this. I kid you not, he refused to respond to them because he said, "I bet they want my money." He was not a rich man, by the way. He cleaned carpets for a living. But he was convinced somehow they're only contacting him because somehow they want something from him. It turns out, yeah, so he had no direct descendants. But, like, they were second. My great-great-grandfather and his, like, I don't know, cousin or something, were second cousin. So, yes, royal blood flows through these veins.
Right,
what I'm saying.
He didn't have kids. They didn't have kids.
Yeah, so there's no one, no direct descendants whatsoever. But I am supposedly an indirect descendant. I don't know. We're related in
cousin
some way.
Polk.
It's done nothing for me in my life whatsoever. But technically, found this out.
I think it's funny that he assumed they wanted money and not just another place to bury James K. Polk. Like, that's the first, if I got a call from the fuck candidates, I'd be like, "You gonna try to bury my yard or something? You run out of places."
That's right.
You keep on burying that dude.
Well, it's funny because when I saw the book and I saw the name and Ben was like, "Oh yeah, he's here at MTSU." I was like, I just, for some reason that crossed my mind. I was like,
yeah,
I wonder if he's related to the Polk, which makes sense. He could come from New Jersey for all we know, like, and got a job at MTSU. But
well, I think we heard him talk already. So
that's right.
Yeah. I'm of the Mississippi Polks. Okay.
All right.
There's no one else around there.
I'll just share this. I think Andy kind of, like, saw the other end of this. We talked about your book when we had lunch, and I was like, "Oh, this is, like, the perfect book and the perfect episode of Road Now." And I just, like, sent it to Bob, and I was like, "Check this out! Like, send the description." And I already talked to you. We're, like, going to book it. And then Bob writes back to me like 10 minutes later. He goes, "I've already contacted them to try to get them on the podcast." And I was like, "What?" Lunch with them. That's how excited we were to have you on. And then
they were like, "Well, we don't know if he can do it. We'll reach out to him."
Yeah, they emailed me afterwards. And they're like, "Hey, are you at all interested in doing this podcast?" And then I was really curious. I was like, "I thought I already was. Like, is there a tryout? Do I need to?"
I didn't know you were at MTSU. So when Ben sent me the description of the book, I just reached out to the Cornell Publishing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so anyway, thank you, everyone at Cornell Press.
Yeah, thank Press? You. And thank you to McCallie's cafeteria, where Andy and I first discussed
this
book. Although we've been friends since you moved here, as sparse as I am around campus, Andy's got an office right next to my wife Kelly, so we stay in touch.
Office,
sometimes
absolutely.
Secondary, I get all the scuttlebutt. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I really appreciate y'all asking me to come on.
Well, we're grateful, and we hope everyone will get a copy of the book. It's called Faith in Freedom, and that's Andrew R. Polk. And so get a copy of it. Great Christmas gift. La Cosecha Coffee, great Christmas gift. Press On Gear merchandise here, great Christmas gift. Road to Now Coffee Mug, great Christmas gift.
Funny so I you just, should say that. I've got one here for Andy Polk. I'm getting ready to give it.
There we go.
So, and finally, don't forget Patreon. Christmas Trivia Party is Tuesday,
all right,
December 21st at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Might be some prizes there too. So,
Last episode of the year. So we look forward to seeing you guys in 2022. But maybe we'll have another episode before that.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word. Text a link to a friend, share a link on social media, or take a minute to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. All of this helps us spread the word about our show. So if you've already done that, thank you. Speaking of thank you, now's the time where we say the special shout out to our supporters on Patreon, with particular emphasis on our Washingtonians. Thank you to Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Ann Williams and Frank Edwards, and Daniel Hansen. To all of you, we are grateful. If you're enjoying what you hear on The Road to Now, you can join us there on Patreon too. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. There are extra episodes, bonus materials, and you can even join us for an upcoming trivia night or live recordings. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. Our patrons keep us going. For more on this episode and our podcast in general, please visit our website, www.theroadtonow.com, where you can easily search our back catalog and quickly find links to content. You're going to be amazed by that website. And you want to know why? Because it was designed by Charles and Destiny at Seven Ages Design. Go check those guys out. They made our lives a lot easier and made us look a lot better. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer and the editor of this episode is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music is by Paul DeFiglia. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thank you for listening. Take care.